The Rice Crust. Now I have a story to tell you. Tiantong Monastery is located at Luoyang in China. It is one of China's largest monasteries, which can house over 500 monks. Chan meditation was conducted every year during the winter months. Chan in the winter, study in the summer. During the winter, meditation sessions were held, and during the summer, sutra lectures and dharma talks were given. So why practice Chan in the winter? The cold weather in the winter helps people work hard. When you feel cold, you will want to work hard. How does one work hard? You have to turn on your own personal heater and fight the cold, and then you won't fear the cold. The colder it gets, the more energy you have. Therefore, when we are conducting a Chan session in the winter, once you have turned on your internal heater, not only will you not be cold, you'll perspire. And so now is the best time to investigate Chan. In warm weather, it's easy to fall asleep. In cold weather, if you fall asleep, you'll be awakened by the cold. And so it is not as easy to fall asleep. So when we cultivate, we should not be afraid of the cold. Long ago in China, those who investigated Chan in the winter did not eat afternoon. What does not eating afternoon mean? It means they ate rice gruel in the morning, but in the evening, they did not eat anything. At that time, someone was working hard, but because he couldn't eat at night, he felt hungry. Feeling hungry, he began to have false thinking. Oh, it's so hard to bear the hunger. It's very uncomfortable. Everybody felt hungry and started to have false thinking. They said, we could steal something to eat. Could we steal Chinese buns? No, they're locked in the kitchen. Could we steal rice? No, it's kept in the storeroom. There is no way to steal it. Well, the monitor had spiritual penetrations. Taking a look, he thought, everybody is so hungry, they're having false thinking about stealing food. This person wants to steal ginseng, and that person wants to steal cottage cheese. How can we allow that to happen? So the monitor thought, I'm going to help them. He used his spiritual penetrations to enter the storeroom and took all the rice crust. Rice crust is the crisp layer of rice at the bottom of the pot. In Canton, they call it rice crisp. In the north, we call it pan crackle. Because in large monasteries, several thousand people were in residence, there was a lot of rice crust left each day. It's not that the rice crust wasn't wanted, that it was thrown in the garbage can and taken away with the rest of the trash. No, the rice crust was kept and cooked with the next day's rice and eaten. When many people live together, if such food is wasted, it would amount to a lot of waste. So things were kept. Each day they kept the rice crust in the storeroom. The monitor used his spiritual penetrations to go into the storeroom, grab a lot of rice crust, and set a piece in front of each person. When the bell rang at the end of the sitting period, each monk saw a piece of rice crust right there in front of him. Stealthily, each stuffed it into his mouth. Every person stole his bite to eat. Here, we can steal ginseng and steal cottage cheese. Master to disciple, you said that there is plenty of that in the storeroom. You may go in the storeroom and steal it. Any one of you who has spiritual penetrations can show them off. Master to another disciple, don't lock the door, however. If you lock the door, their spiritual penetrations won't be sufficient to let them get in. So anyway, each monk ate his rice crust and after eating it, felt that it helped him use effort, that he was able to work hard. The monitor stole today, stole tomorrow, stole the next day, and so on for many days until he had stolen all the rice crust in the storeroom. The cook asked the storeroom manager, "Where is the rice crust?" The storeroom manager said, "Didn't you cook it in the rice?" "No, I didn't." "No? Then where is it? How do I know? I don't know. Then the store manager said, "This will never do. We have to go see the abbot." They went together to see the abbot. Abbot Mizu also had spiritual penetrations. The storeroom manager said, "All the rice crust in the storeroom has disappeared. We don't know why." Abbot Mizu said, "How could it have disappeared? Of course you cooked it and ate it, and so it's gone." The storeroom manager said, "No, the rice cook said he did not cook it, but there isn't any in the storeroom either." Abbot Mizu said, "Maybe it was eaten by mice." "Okay, forget it." Then the abbot looked into it. "Oh, it's you, monitor. You act like that. Ah, you have broken the precepts. You have stolen things. All right." So on that day, Abbot Mizu also went into the Chan Hall to meditate with the assembly. Sure enough, the monitor went off to the storeroom to steal things. However, he used his spirit, his spiritual soul, not his physical body, to go to the storeroom. His physical body remained seated there. How were his spiritual penetrations? Well, he could retrieve things back with him just by contemplating. He brought things back with him. But meanwhile, Abbot Mizu had stashed the monitor's physical body, still holding meditation posture, under a meditation bench. When the monitor who stole things returned, he could not find his body on the bench. He looked about for it and finally discovered it under the bench. He had to wiggle his way out from under the monitor's meditation bench. As he was crawling out, the abbot said, "What are you doing coming out from under there? Are you stealing things in this monastery? You've stolen all the rice crust, and you are still doing it. You have to leave. You can't stay here anymore." The monitor said, "Fine, you can kick me out, but the monks in this assembly are too hungry to work. If I have to leave, I want to request that you allow these people a little something to eat in the evening." The abbot said, "You just go. This is none of your concern. You go. I'm kicking you out. But if you do not promise to give them something to eat, I will not leave." All right," Abbot Mizu told the monitor. "After you go, I will give everyone 2 vegetarian buns each evening." Then the monitor left, and from then on, buns were served each night. Meanwhile, the monitor used his spiritual penetrations to travel from Tiantong Monastery to Nanjing. Once he reached Nanjing, originally he planned to go to Guiyan Monastery in Hangzhou in time for lunch, but when he passed through the bustling city of Nanjing, he stopped to watch an opera. Afterwards, he used his spiritual penetrations to go to Guiyan Monastery. At that time, the abbot of Guiyan Monastery also had spiritual penetrations, and so he said, "Today, a monk is coming for lunch. We will eat first and then hit the bong. When he hears the sound of the bong, he will come for lunch. And so, first we eat and then we hit the bong." The bong is a wooden board carved in the shape of a fish. When it is hit, the sound is bong, 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 and so it's called a bong. Why did the abbot want everyone to eat first? It's because he knew that the monitor had stopped to watch an opera in Nanjing, and so he thought, "All right, you watch a show, and I won't let you eat." After the monitor finished watching the show, he went to Hangzhou. When he arrived, he heard the bong and went to eat lunch, but he saw that all the people at Guiyan Monastery had already eaten. Everyone ate first, and then the bong was hit. He said, "Why aren't you eating? We've already eaten. You don't follow the rules here. You should hit the bong first and then eat." The abbot said, "Who told you to watch an opera?" The monitor thought about that and had nothing to say in reply, so he left. He went directly to Sichuan. It's quite a long distance from Hangzhou to Sichuan, but he reached there quickly by using his spiritual penetrations. When he arrived there, he sat beneath 2 cinnamon trees to meditate. Later, he established a monastery there named Twin Cinnamon Hall, which is also very well known. Question: Why is it that some monastic and lay cultivators cultivate so that they emit a light while others do not? Some have radiated a light since they were young. What's the reason behind that? Answer by the Master. Don't be attached to that. Cultivate whether there's light or not. Don't be full of yourself if you have an aura. The aura disappears as soon as you're attached. People who don't have any light can have that light if they cultivate. Don't be attached to these superficialities. Just work hard and cultivate honestly. Proceed boldly and vigorously according to the Buddha Dharma. Don't back down. Don't be concerned about light or no light. When the time comes, you'll radiate light even when you don't want to. When it's not yet time and you haven't reached that level, there will be no light, even though you want light. Who is asking? As to investigating the meditation topic who, it's said that while inquiring, if a big doubt comes up, then one's enlightenment can be big. If only a minor doubt arises, then one's enlightenment will be small. If no doubt is generated by the topic, then one will obtain no enlightenment. Before a Chan meditation session, we always have a Buddha recitation session. After the recitation session, we hold the Chan session. This way, we can expect better results. First, we recite the Buddha's name. Then we investigate the question, who is mindful of the Buddha? To investigate means to look for the one who is mindful of the Buddha. Is it a ghost? Which ghost is it? Is it a person? Which person is it? Is it me? After I die, will I still be mindful? After I'm put in the coffin, will no one be mindful? Find the final answer to the question, who? How about the asker of who? Can you tell who is mindful of the Buddha? Who is asking? You can't find out. No matter how long you look, you won't find out who it is. If you actually find out who, then you won't have the least bit of idle thinking left. Why do you still have idle thoughts? It's just because you haven't found out who. This question of who can be sought for a great aeon. When you see those meditation adepts sitting absolutely still, it's because they're working on finding the who. Their search for this one word brings them to a state of concentration where not even one idle thought arises. Suddenly, at that point, they can get enlightened and in the midst of darkness bring forth bright light that shows them absolutely everything. It's said, when one is confused, an entire library of books is too few. But when one is enlightened, even a single word is too many. This expresses the principle we use in investigating the meditation topic. Anyone who can be entirely free of idle thoughts is a person with skill. Anyone who entertains idle thoughts is someone whose spiritual skill is still immature. This is the central idea underlying the practice of Chan meditation. The skill of Chan meditation comes from concentrating the mind and looking into the topic so that when walking, sitting, and reclining, you are investigating at all times. To sum it up, you must work at it constantly. Don't pass up this opportunity to investigate. This is why during the Chan session, no one bows to the Buddha, recites sutras, does ceremonies, or eats in the formal style. At lunchtime, we take our meal, and then we hurry back to the meditation hall and continue to meditate. When one has to go to the bathroom, one takes care of business and then returns immediately to the hall to continue to meditate. We don't waste even 1 minute or second of the session because who knows in which minute or second we'll become enlightened. This is why we treasure every moment of time. So it said, do not depart from this. Do not depart from what? Don't depart from the question, who is mindful of the Buddha? This who is a wisdom sword that cuts through the 7 emotions and 6 desires. Once you've gotten rid of your faults and habits for good, your fundamental nature can appear. Once your fundamental nature appears, the fruition of Bodhi will be accomplished. Question. Master, which Dharma master do you most respect in this lifetime? Answer by the master. Venerable Master Xu Yun. Question. Please describe the spirit of Venerable Master Xu Yun. Answer by the master. He did not sleep. Extraordinary diligence brings Elder Master Xu Yun's awakening. When those of old applied their effort, they would renounce death and forget about life. They weren't afraid of toil. They wouldn't waste a single second. They were totally concentrated, worked hard, and hoped that by using their effort in the right way, they could one day recognize their original face and obliterate the wheel of birth and death. When the Venerable Xu Yun was residing in a thatched hut on Zhongnan Mountain, he heard that the cultivators at Gaomin Monastery were going to hold a 10-week meditation session, which would begin on July 19th. The master decided to attend the session and left for Gaomin Monastery, determined to end birth and death. While he was descending Jiuhua Mountain, it began to rain, and it rained so hard that the roads were all submerged in water. He remembered that along the road there was a bridge, but he didn't know that it had been wiped out by the torrential rain. So as he walked along that particular road, because the bridge had been wiped out, he slipped and fell into the river. For a day and a night, 24 hours, he tossed in the waves and bobbed up and down in the current. How could he have lived through that? It so happened that there was a fisherman working along the river, and when he cast his net, by chance he caught Master Xu Yun and pulled him out of the river. At first the fisherman thought that he'd caught a huge fish, but as soon as he reeled in his net and took a closer look, he realized that this was, in fact, a monk. The fisherman observed that the monk had taken in a lot of water, so he lifted him onto a large rock and proceeded to empty the water out of his lungs. Now, it's reasonable to suppose that after being submerged in water for 24 hours like that, one could not possibly have survived. But the Venerable Master Xu Yun came back to life. The fisherman next went to a local monastery and told a monk there, "I caught a monk in my net while fishing." The local monk returned with the fisherman to the scene of the accident and took a look. When he saw the Venerable Master, he exclaimed, "Oh, this is Venerable De Qing." He was referring to Venerable Master Xu Yun's other ordained name. So he took Venerable Master Xu Yun back to his monastery to rest there for a few days. If the Venerable Master had not been so determined in seeking the way, he might have thought, "Oh, I was on my way to the session and just about drowned in the river, so I'm not going to that session now. I'm going to retreat. I'm going back to the mountain and stay there in my thatched hut." But he wasn't like that. He maintained his resolve to go on and participate in the session. So he proceeded to Gaomin Monastery after a few days and registered as a participant. Because he had been in the water for a day and a night, he was seriously ill. In what way was he ill? His nose, eyes, ears, and his mouth all constantly bled. Even his anus and urinary tract flowed with blood, and his vital energies drained away. But even though he was so sick, he still didn't retreat. It never occurred to him to resign from the session. Now, no one at Gaomin Monastery was aware of the Venerable Master's condition. No one had heard the news that he almost drowned in the river. Nor did the Master bother to tell anyone. He was prepared to enter the Chan Hall and join the session. A preparatory session was held on July 15th. Since the abbot of Gaomin Monastery himself wanted to participate in the session, he requested that the Venerable Xu Yun act as abbot in his place so that he would be able to attend the session without having to be distracted by monastic affairs. But Master Yun wouldn't agree to this, and so, according to the tradition of the Chan Hall, the abbot had him beaten with an incense board and scolded him, saying things like, "You haven't brought forth the resolve of a bodhisattva. and gave him a big harangue. By that time, the Venerable Xu Yun was like a living dead person, and so that when people beat him, he didn't feel the pain. When people scolded him, that living dead person did not even hear it. He endured insult in that way. He was able to endure it all. Shortly after that, the abbot of the local monastery where Master Yun had stayed after his accident showed up at Gaomin Monastery, and he explained to everyone there. The Venerable Master De Qing descended Jiuhua Mountain, and on his way to this session, he fell into the river and remained in the water for a day and a night, 24 hours, and then he was fished out and revived. He came back to life. On hearing this bit of news, everyone knew that Master Yun was one who had truly forsaken death and forgotten about life in order to participate in this session. Then the participants in the Chan session got together and discussed the situation among themselves. It was the custom that those who participated in a session took turns taking the incense board and going on meditation patrol. When everyone else was sitting, the one on meditation patrol would carry the incense board around the hall to see who was sleeping, and whoever was sleeping would get hit with the incense board. But because the Venerable Master Yun had forsaken death and forgotten about life in order to attend the session, everyone felt sympathetic toward his resolve, and they all agreed among themselves and said to him, "You nearly drowned, and you're really sick, so you needn't take a turn on the meditation patrol." Thus, he was relieved of his turn on the meditation patrol. Not having to do that, he was able to single-mindedly work hard. He concentrated with a single focus, day and night, without ever interrupting his effort. But his illness still raged. His nine orifices kept on bleeding, and his vital energies ebbed away, even from his urinary tract. In spite of this serious illness, he didn't rest. He still worked hard, just as always. One evening during the session, it came time for tea. Because Master Yun was intent upon investigating his meditation topic, his eyes were closed. As he held out his cup, something happened. Maybe the tea server was sleepy. Anyway, the tea server accidentally poured hot tea all over Master Yun's hand and scalded it, causing the master to release the cup and let it drop to the floor. The cup fell to the floor with a crash, and the sound prompted him to an instantaneous enlightenment. It was a far-reaching and profound awakening. Recalling that moment, Master Yun wrote this verse. The cup crashed to the floor with a sound crisp and clear. Empty space broke apart, and the mad mind suddenly stopped. When the cup smashed to the floor, his ignorance was smashed to bits, and he found his original face. He understood everything and immediately became enlightened. Becoming enlightened, he immediately understood everything. Reflect upon this story. Elder Master Xu Yun, a lofty and virtuous monk, worked so hard and subsequently was able to open enlightenment. Question. Why is the master's memory so excellent? How should most people develop that? Answer by the master. Practice being without outflows in life after life. Question. How do we cultivate having no outflows? Answer by the master. Go back and read the Sharingama Sutra more often. Letting go. Let the four elements go. Do not grasp at them. The nature of still quiescence accords with drinking and eating. All activities are impermanent. Everything is empty. This is the great and perfect enlightenment of the Thus Come Ones. What are the four elements? They are earth, water, fire, and wind, and they all pervade the Dharma realm. Earth, water, and fire have appearance, but wind does not have any appearance. Our bodies are falsely united by these four elements. when the four elements are unified, then a body is formed. When the four elements disperse, the body is gone. Flesh and bone and all the hard things belong to the element earth. Mucus, saliva, tears, and all liquids of the body belong to the element water. The heat of our bodies belongs to the element fire, and our breath belongs to the element wind. When these four elements come together, they form a human body. When these four elements scatter, then we no longer have our body. They each return to their own kind. The earth element of our body goes back to the element earth. The water element of our body goes back to the element water. The fire element of our body goes back to the element fire. The wind element of our body goes back to the element wind. They all go back to where they belong. Therefore, we say that the four elements are falsely united. Since our body is made out of the false unity of four elements, what relationship does our body have with us? If we can understand that our bodies truly are not anything special, there is nothing for us to cling to in our bodies, then why is each of us so attached to our body? Why can we not see through it? Why can we not put it down? So the verse says, do not grasp at them. We must break our attachment to those elements that form our bodies. We have to see the body for what it is. Do not grasp at them means to see through and put down, to let go. To put down is just to loosen up, to untie, or to get rid of those attachments. Rather, one should let go and not be attached to the four elements, earth, water, fire, and wind. The verse says the nature of still quiescence accords with drinking and eating. The nature of tranquility is simply the Buddha nature. It is the enlightened nature inherent in us all. Accords with drinking and eating means we should just be natural. We should not feign anything. Everything should simply happen spontaneously. Each act we do, such as drinking water and eating food, should be done naturally. The Buddha nature is found in everyday things. The verse says accords with drinking and eating, and that means all acts should be natural and not forced. All activities are impermanent. Everything is empty. Since all activities are impermanent, then they are empty. As it is stated, all marks are empty and false. If you can see all marks as no marks, then you can see the thus come one. Thus, all activities are impermanent, and since all activities are impermanent, they are mere emptiness. That is the great and perfect enlightenment of the thus come ones. Some versions use all Buddhas instead of thus come ones. All Buddhas and thus come ones are the same. It's just that thus come ones sounds a little better than all Buddhas does here, because this verse is part of a song. Using the thus come one makes the song harmonious. Everything is empty means everything is found in the original self nature of the thus come ones of the ten directions. Question. How can we accomplish great things? Answer by the Master. Someone who can do great things will do what others cannot do. To be able to withstand the worst form of misery, one becomes the best among the best. But this is not about being different or competitive. Gradually arrive at sudden understanding. The Dharma door of Chan meditation points directly to the human mind. It teaches us to see our nature and to become a Buddha. It is also called the sudden teaching. The teaching of sudden enlightenment is brought to success by cultivating the gradual teaching. A verse says, one may suddenly enlighten to the principles, but putting those principles into practice happens gradually. Now, in our daily deportment, whether moving or still, we are cultivating gradually. Then in the future, there will be a day when we truly understand and become suddenly enlightened. That's what we mean by sudden. The sudden, in fact, is not apart from the gradual, and the gradual also aids the sudden. Sudden enlightenment is a result of daily cultivation. When you get a response from your daily efforts, you can suddenly be enlightened. If you normally don't cultivate, then you can never gain sudden enlightenment. Similarly, after a child is born, he is steeped in words and sounds every day. When the time comes, he is naturally able to talk. When he says his very first word, it's analogous to the enlightenment experience. When the time comes, he'll naturally be able to walk, and that first step he takes is like the enlightenment experience. How can he take his first step? Because he watches adults walking all day long, every day. Being steeped in that environment, very naturally, he'll be able to walk. Cultivation works the same way. We cultivate today, we cultivate tomorrow, we cultivate back and forth until our skill elicits a response. Then, when not a single thought is produced and our idle thoughts are dispelled, we'll be enlightened. Such an enlightenment may be the result of having worked hard at cultivation all the time, every day in this life. When our skill is mature, we become enlightened. This enlightenment results from our cultivation in this lifetime. You may say, I saw a person who hadn't been vigorous at all in cultivation, and he got enlightened as soon as he started to meditate. How do you explain that? That's an exceptional case. Although he may not have been cultivating in this life, he did cultivate in previous lives. Not only did he cultivated ceaselessly. He was only a hair's breadth away from enlightenment. In this life, as soon as he encountered this kind of environment, he was enlightened. Although sudden enlightenment is instantaneous, it depends upon all of the good roots one has carefully and continually nurtured in past lives. It is just like a farmer tending a field. In the spring, he sows the seeds. In the summer, he weeds and hoes. Then in the autumn, there are crops to harvest. If in the spring the seeds are not planted, how could there possibly be a harvest in the autumn? That is to say, one share of plowing and weeding yields one share of harvest. We cultivators of the spiritual path are the same. Whether or not we become enlightened, we still should be vigorous and courageous in our cultivation. We should energetically stride forward. Then we have hope of gathering our harvest in the final moment. We can see our true identity, know our original face. When we hold a chan session, we are taming our bodies and regulating our minds. Taming the body keeps it from acting in random, impulsive ways. Regulating the mind means not allowing it to indulge in idle thoughts, so it's always pure and clear. Then, no matter where we go, to the ends of space or the limits of the Dharma realm, we're still right within our self-nature. Our inherent nature contains absolutely everything. Nothing falls outside of it. It's just our fundamental Buddha nature. From limitless numbers of aeons in the past, life after life, in world after world, wherever we appeared, we've been deeply deluded and defiled by deviant knowledge and views. So it's not very easy for us to understand our minds and see our natures. For this reason, we need to participate in meditation sessions. A session is a period of time set aside for seeking realization. During this special period, we are determined to gain benefit. We must certainly apply effort and seek understanding. If we want to truly understand, the very first thing that we need to do is to learn to be as if we don't understand anything at all. Here in the Chan Hall, what is our method of cultivation? We don't know. We are not aware of heaven above, earth below, or people in between. What did we do all day long? We don't know. What did we eat? We're not aware. What clothes are we wearing? We don't know. In this state of complete absorption, where we bring ourselves to know nothing at all, we approach a state like this. When one can train oneself to appear as if foolish, then one's genuine cleverness comes forth. If one can study until one appears dull, then one's real talents begin to appear. Another verse for starting a Chan session. Don't be greedy for esoteric wonders. Investigate Chan every hour, day, month, and year. Don't misuse the mind in being greedy for esoteric wonders. If you can reflect within at all times, after leaping out of the wheel of rebirth, there's another world. Sitting quietly for an instant. The old man of Mount Wei said, when an old monk sits once in meditation, he can digest 10,000 ounces of gold. Today I will relate a true account about sitting quietly for an instant. Long ago, Chan Master Ling Yo lived at Mount Wei in Hunan Province in China. He was known as the Old Man of Mount Wei. He built a hut and cultivated on the mountain, and after several years, many people came to know of him as a cultivator who had true virtue in the Wei. Many people came to pay their respects. When the news reached Prime Minister Pei Shou, he too went to call on him. As soon as he had a conversation with the old man of Mount Wei, he felt the affinities were very deep, and inspired by his faith in him, he thought, "You are really a lofty monk who has the Wei, but you're living in such a shabby, broken-down hut. It leaks when it rains and the wind blows through. It's too bitter. You can build a monastery here. I'll give you the money." On the spot, he gave the old man 300 ounces of silver. Well, the value of silver at that time was such that 300 ounces could have built 10 monasteries like the one we are now in, which was the former Gold Mountain Monastery. In those days, a piece of silver could build a lot of things. Prime Minister Pei Shou, acting as a great Dharma protector, offered up 300 ounces of silver. But the old man of Mount Wei didn't have a safe or a safety deposit box or even a special place to put it in. So Prime Minister Pei Shou simply set the money outside the hut in the grass and left. 3 years later, Prime Minister Pei Shou returned to call upon the old man of Mount Wei and found him still living in the same shabby hut. He thought, "Oh, I gave this monk 300 ounces of silver. What did he do with it? Did he use it to buy wine? Did he buy meat with it? How strange, 300 ounces of silver. And he didn't build a monastery. He's still living in this broken-down hut." He went in and saw that the old man of Mount Wei was just the same as before. And so he asked him, "3 years ago, I gave you 300 ounces of silver and told you to build a monastery. Why didn't you do it? What have you done with the money?" The old man of Mount Wei said, "Silver, where did you put it? Go look for it there." Pei Shou thought to himself, "At that time, there was no place to put it, so I left it in the grass." Then he went to search in the grass, and sure enough, the silver was still there. It hadn't moved an inch. The old man of Mount Wei hadn't even gathered up the money to put it in a safe place out of fear that someone might steal it. Prime Minister Pei Shou thought, "Oh, he's really a lofty monk who has attained the Wei. For 3 years, he didn't even touch that 300 ounces of silver. I should build a monastery for him." Then he took out some more money and built a huge monastery that could house more than 3,000 people. After the monastery was built, many monks who practiced Chan meditation went there to cultivate. The monastery could house over 3,000 people, and more than 2,000 people had already gone there to reside. Pei Shou thought, "Ah, so many monks are living here together. I will tell my son to leave the home life." Then Pei Shou sent his son, a Hanling scholar who was extremely learned, on a par with the present-day full professor, to leave the home life. What did the old man of Mount Wei tell this son of the prime minister to do? He said, since you have just become a monk, first you have to practice austerities. I appoint you water carrier. You must haul water every day for the 2,000 and some people who live here. Thus, he had to rise each morning shortly after 2 o'clock and carry water all day long until midnight. The other monks sat in meditation while he hauled water. Back and forth he went, hauling water for several years. During those several years of hauling water, he didn't do anything else. He had no time to study the sutras, no time to bow to the Buddhas, no time to formally recite the Buddha's name. His cultivation consisted solely of carrying water and reciting the Buddha's name as he went. He did not have a fixed time to concentrate on studying the sutras or any opportunity to recite the Buddha's name together with everyone else. He was a novice. He had to do hard work. After carrying water for several years, he thought, everyone resides in the Chan Hall. I'm going to take a look and see what goes on in a Chan Hall. It just so happened that when he stole a peek in the hall, this monk was snoring and that monk was sleeping, and the more he looked, the more he saw, they were all like that. He said to himself, wow, I've been working so hard every day carrying water for you to drink and use in cooking. All along I thought you were working hard at your cultivation, but in fact, you're only sleeping here. Really, here I am, a Hanling scholar, toting water so you have the opportunity to sleep? He was extremely upset. As soon as he got upset, the abbot sent an attendant to summon him. In all those years, he'd never seen his teacher. He'd never seen the abbot. Now he'd had a chance to see his teacher, and the old man in Mount Wei said to him, pack up your things and get out. We can't use you here. You're being kicked out. Peisho's son said, but what have I done wrong? Why are you throwing me out? The old man said, what have you done? Why did you say all those things about people sleeping? That you came here and worked, you, a Hanling scholar hauling water to feed a bunch of people who like to sleep. Did you or did you not have those false thoughts? He replied, yes, I saw them sleeping in the Chan Hall. The old man of Mount Wei said, when an old monk sits once in meditation, he is worth 10,000 ounces of gold. You're not even worth 1 ounce of gold. You're not even able to stand being a Hanling scholar who hauls water. Just take a look at yourself. You don't have the least bit of patience. You'll have to go. I refuse to keep you here. Peisho's son, whose name was Fahai, then knelt before the abbot and begged, please don't kick me out. Please forgive me this time. The abbot said, no, I can't forgive such a useless person. Pack up and get out fast. Well, he was kicked out, and that was that. After Fahai had packed his things, he asked, please tell me where I should go. Where should I live? The old man gave him 8.5 cents and said, dwell right where you happen to be when you spend the last of this 8.5 cents. As long as you have even 0.5 cent left, you should keep moving. Carrying that 8.5 cents, Fahai went down the mountain. He begged for food as he traveled because he dared not spend the 8.5 cents. He went straight through Hunan to Nanjing. As he crossed the river at Zhejiang, intending to climb the mountain on the other side, the ferryman didn't ask for more and didn't ask for less. He wanted exactly 8.5 cents for the fare. Since all the money was spent for the fare, once he reached that mountain, he didn't leave. He stayed on Gold Mountain. Originally, that mountain was not called Gold Mountain. What was its name? Well, there's no way to trace it. So how did it come to be called Gold Mountain? When Fahai first arrived on the mountain, he found a cave and lived in it. One night, the cave radiated light. He went further into the cave to trace the source of the light and discovered 2 crocks full of gold there. He then used the gold to build Jiang Tian Monastery. And so in China, that mountain is named Gold Mountain because 2 full crocks of gold were discovered there by him. He established a way place there, and to this day, it is one of China's most famous way places when it comes to meditation. A verse for starting a Chan session. walking toward Bodhi. There is an August 9th in every year. This year, we all walk toward Bodhi together. Stop the pulse, stop the breath, and stop thoughts as well. Attain the four dhyanas, the four fruitions, up to great enlightenment. The four dhyanas. When we sit in chan meditation, we shouldn't be greedy for flavorful chan, meaning the bliss of the dhyanas. When meditators sit for a period of time, most will begin to experience a sense of lightness and ease. If that comfortable sensation makes them indolent, or if they become greedy to remain in that state, then it will not be easy for those meditators to progress. They will want to linger there. They will keep trying to return to that state of flavorful chan. When that state subsides, they will pursue it thinking, when am I going to have that kind of state again? In that state, there was no self, no others, no living beings, and no lifespans, no afflictions, and no hassles. It was so blissful, so comfortable, and I felt so free. I wonder when I will ever have that experience again. When meditators get stuck like that, they just keep waiting for that flavorful experience to reoccur. Waiting, they forget all about applying effort. That's known as attachment to flavorful chan. Cultivators of chan need to be free of obstructions and hang-ups. We cannot be craving anything. We cannot get excessively happy or depressed, and we shouldn't have any fear or terror. We should see our body as being the same as empty space in the Dharma realm. There's no need to cling to anything or crave anything. As soon as practitioners crave something, they fall into a secondary level of truth. Those who can sit in meditation until they reach a state where inside there is no body, outside there is no world, and afar there are no objects, then they can realize the state where there is no trace of self, no trace of others, no trace of living beings, and no trace of lifespans. This state is also described as thoughts of the past cannot be obtained, thoughts of the present cannot be obtained, and thoughts of the future cannot be obtained. Even if you do reach this level of attainment, it still cannot be considered actual skill. It is not all that special. Suppose you can sit still for 1 hour, or 10 hours, or 1 month, or 10 months. That's only a sign that you have had a bit of response in your work, that you've attained a state of lightness and ease. You must keep up your practice of meditation continuously, pass through the stage of lightness and ease to actually reach the level of the first dhyana concentration. The first dhyana is known as the stage of happiness that leaves living beings behind. It means that you have reached a stage of happiness beyond that which ordinary living beings enjoy. Leaving the afflictions of living beings, you obtain the happiness of taking dhyana bliss for food and of being filled with the joy of Dharma. Leaving the confusion of living beings, you start advancing along the Bodhi path of the sages. Arriving at the first dhyana isn't something you can fake. It isn't something you can claim for yourself. A good and wise advisor must certify the state for you. When you are in this stage in your meditation, you quickly enter samadhi concentration. In this samadhi, your breathing stops, and you no longer inhale or exhale. Breath neither comes nor goes. You're like a turtle hibernating in the winter with its head drawn back into its shell. External breathing comes to rest. Internal breathing comes alive. Creatures in winter hibernation abide in a state like that. Chan meditators can enter samadhi to the point that their breath stops, but as soon as they leave samadhi, their breathing returns to normal. Please attend to this point, everyone. When you reach this stage, you cannot have the false thought, oh, I believe my breath has stopped. As soon as that thought occurs to you, your breath starts right up again, immediately. You can't be careless, or else you'll lose your chance and have to start all over again. When you reach that state, there's proof. The proof is that you no longer inhale or exhale. Your breath has stopped, although you aren't dead. You have entered the samadhi of the first dhyana. It's different from sleep, so you shouldn't think that going to sleep is the same as entering samadhi. When you are sleeping, you continue to breathe, and you may even snore so loudly that it sounds like thunder to your neighbors. An experienced mentor can tell immediately whether or not your breath has stopped. To simply announce, "I feel like my breath has stopped," doesn't make it so. If you know, then you haven't even entered the first dhyana. So don't try to put on a false sign and sell counterfeit goods. If I were to go into this in detail, there are a lot of principles that could be talked about. And I could write a whole essay on this, but if I say too much, it only creates obstacles. So I've just said a little bit to prevent you from becoming arrogant and misled by deviant views and claiming to have entered the first dhyana. From the stage of the first dhyana, if you can make vigorous progress, you enter into the second dhyana. This stage is known as the stage of happiness that brings concentration. When you are constantly in this samadhi, it brings along a quality of happiness which is completely unparalleled and indescribable. It's a further advance in taking the joy of chan as your food and being filled with the bliss of dharma. When you meditate at the stage of the second dhyana, not only does your breath stop, but your pulse stops as well. Please note that stop does not mean it's cut off for good. When you leave this state of concentration, the pulse returns to normal. Again, you will not know when you arrive at this state. You cannot claim you have reached it. If you say you feel that you have, how do you know? You haven't even entered samadhi yet, so are you trying to fool people by faking it? In the third dhyana, the wonderful bliss of leaving happiness, your breath, pulse, and even your thoughts will cease. In these heavens, you have left happiness and renounced flavorful chan. You don't have the slightest attachment or greed for the comfort of flavorful chan. This state is much higher than that of the first and second dhyanas. All the hair pores on your body are blissful when you enter the third dhyana. They are really, really delighted. That is to say, you leave coarse happiness behind and reach a level of subtle bliss that is most wonderful. In this stage of bliss beyond happiness, when you enter the state of concentration, not only do breath and pulse stop, but also your thoughts in your mind stop, and you appear just like a dead person. When your thoughts stop, then you obviously have no more idle thinking. Your breathing comes to rest. Your blood receives no more oxygen, so it stops circulating. When your heart no longer beats, then your pulse stops. At this time, you entertain no further scattered thoughts. It's as if the breath were the wind, the pulse were the waves, and the thoughts of the mind were the water. If there is no wind, then there are no waves, and the water is naturally calm. As the saying goes, the wind is calm and the waves are still. This is a temporary experience which occurs in samadhi. It's not as final as death. You can recover your normal breathing and pulse anytime you please. When you continue to apply vigorous effort in chan meditation past the third dhyana, you can enter the fourth dhyana, known as the pure stage free of thoughts. You have now left behind the wonderful bliss of the third dhyana, and the mind is pure. With the breath, pulse, and thoughts stopped and left behind, the pure, inherent, wonderful nature of true suchness manifests. You should not think that just because you can enter this state that you are special. It is only the fourth dhyana and not a sign of having realized some fruition of sagehood in the way. It is still the state of an ordinary person. Because you have not cut off all desire, if you make vigorous progress in cultivating the deviant concentration of externalist sects, you will enter the heaven of no thought and enjoy a state of bliss. If instead you cultivate proper concentration, then you can enter the five heavens of no further return. Only then have you actually reached the state of a certified sage. In the fourth dhyana, you experience nothing at all. When not a single thought arises, the entire substance manifests. You reach that state where 1,000 pools contain water. The moon is reflected in all of them. For 10,000 miles, there are no clouds. There are 10,000 miles of sky. Everything is speaking the Dharma. Falling flowers and flowing water proclaim the Mahayana. But you don't know it when you are in this state, and you can't say, I've reached the heavens of the fourth dhyana. That would be gross arrogance on your part, and you would be telling a big lie. One must be certified by a good and wise advisor for it to count. Now, a good and wise advisor is called a clear-eyed person because he can take one look at you and know what level your cultivation is. If you want to test him out, go ahead, but he won't pay any attention to you. A true good and wise advisor will not be tested by you, and he won't tell you all the secrets just because you ask. You must draw near such a mentor for a long time, and then he may tell you, but not in a very obvious way. Sometimes he might use an analogy or just say a few words, so you can't go around proclaiming, we've all become Buddhas. You would be telling a big lie. But the joke will be on you, because in the future, those who tell big lies have to endure the hell of pulling out tongues. To have that happen would be really pathetic. So please, pay attention to this point, everyone. Don't say that you've realized what you haven't realized, or that you've obtained a state you haven't actually obtained. To say such things breaks the precept against false speech. In the future, people who say such things will fall into the hells where tongues are ripped out. Whether or not you believe my words is up to you. I'm simply giving you advance warning. In Buddhist circles, you can find people who claim to be already enlightened. To make this claim is wrong. Even if you're enlightened, you can't boast, did you know that I'm enlightened? I have the 5 spiritual eyes and the 6 psychic powers. Don't advertise yourself. It's totally meaningless. Verse by the Master. Playing a flute with no holes. With heaven and earth rent topsy-turvy during a chant session, stars can be plucked and the moon replaced. In front of the shadowless mountain, turn around and look. A true person always plays a flute with no holes. Masters Han Shan, Cold Mountain, and Shi De, the Foundling. Even Buddhas and Bodhisattvas do not advertise themselves. When it becomes known that a certain person is a Bodhisattva, or that a certain person is a Buddha who has come into the world by transformation, those people will promptly leave. During the Tang Dynasty, there were 2 such great masters, Han Shan and Shi De. Great Master Han Shan was Manjushri Bodhisattva's transformation. Great Master Shi De was Samadabhadra Bodhisattva's transformation. And the two were best friends. Great Master Shi De was an orphan, found on the roadside by the abbot Feng Gan of Guoqing Monastery, and he was raised in the monastery. He worked in the kitchen boiling the water. He would pack leftover rice and vegetables into a bamboo crock and save them for Great Master Han Shan, who lived in Moonlight Cave behind the monastery. Great Master Han Shan came down to Guoqing Monastery every day to get the offering of leftovers. Since the 2 fellow cultivators constantly joked and laughed together, the other monks thought they were fools and left them alone. Nobody knew they were actually Bodhisattva's transformations, who had come into the world playfully to take across living beings who were ready to be saved. One day the magistrate, Liu Qiuyin, visited Abbot Feng Gan, who was the transformation of Amitabha Buddha, And he asked him, "Venerable Sir, in the past, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas often sent their transformations into the world. Do they still come to the world or not?" Abbot Fengan said, "Yes, they do. It's only that we don't recognize them. Right now, the monk who boils water in the kitchen at Wuching Monastery on Tiantai Mountain is a transformation of Samatha Bahadra Bodhisattva. And his fellow cultivator is Hanshan, who in reality is Manjushri Bodhisattva, who claims that they no longer appear in the world." The magistrate was delighted with this news and took his leave. He headed directly for the kitchen of the monastery, intending to pay sincere homage to the two bodhisattvas, Hanshan and Shirde. When he arrived at Guoqing Monastery, the guest prefect recognized him as an honored guest and received him with all due courtesy. When he heard that the magistrate wished to see Hanshan and Shirde, the prefect thought it was quite strange. He couldn't understand why the magistrate was interested in meeting those two fools. Although he was puzzled, he led the magistrate into the kitchen where Hanshan and Shirde were talking and laughing, hysterically, looking truly comical. The magistrate, nonetheless, made very sincere bows to the two of them and then stated with utmost reverence, "I, disciple Lu Qiuyin, asks the two bodhisattvas for their compassionate regard. Please give instructions to this confused mortal." Great Master Shirde asked him, "What are you doing?" The magistrate replied, "Abbot Fengan said that you two are the transformations of Manjushri and Samatha Bahadra bodhisattvas. I came out especially to bow to you and to earnestly seek your instructions." Great Master Shirde heard this reply and stepped backward. He said, "Fengan is always prattling. Fengan is a tattletale. He's the transformation of Amitabha Buddha. Why don't you bow to him instead of coming to bow to us?" As he spoke, he continued to walk backwards out the door of the temple and all the way to the foot of Moonlight Cave on the face of Tiantai Mountain. Great Master Hanshan followed him, and when the two reached the rock face, they simply vanished right into the mountain. The magistrate watched in amazement as the two bodhisattvas hid themselves, and he felt deep disappointment. He thought, "I must quickly go bow to Amitabha Buddha." But by the time he returned to the abbot's place, Abbot Fengan had already entered the stillness of nirvana. The magistrate had mistaken what was right before his eyes. This is known as being face-to-face with Guanyin, yet failing to recognize him. Guanxirin Bodhisattva is always here in the Chan Hall with us, but I don't want to tell you who he is, for fear that once you know, you'll drive him away.